It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk about a new study that suggests firstborn children are actually smarter than their younger siblings. We'll find out some of the explanations why that could be.
First, according to a new study, the amount of gun violence shown in PG-13 films has more than tripled since 1985, the year the rating was introduced.
And some of the most popular PG-13 films in recent years have contained as much or more violence than their R-rated counterparts. So what effect, if any, is this having on younger viewers?
Joining us now is Brad Bushman. He's co-author of the study and professor of communication and psychology at The Ohio State University. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, as we said in the introduction there, gun violence, you found, is more than tripled in PG-13 movies. Now, I think a lot of families see this as sort of the softball rating, which is good for a lot of age groups. But what do you make of that finding?
It's very disturbing, especially since the Motion Picture Association of America's MPAA website says that R-rated films contain more violence than PG-13-rated films. And actually, the exact opposite is true. PG-13 films contain significantly more gun violence than R-rated films.
I guess the big question is why? Why is there so much violence in this particular niche rating instead of, you know, R, where it's supposed to be?
Well, I think because the industry wants money, and PG-13 films attract much larger audiences than R-rated films. So that's my guess.
It used to be that if you really wanted to, you know, sell your movie, you marketed to teenage boys. Is that still true? And if it is that part of this?
Well, I think PG-13 films are marketed to teen audiences, and it's troubling that they contain significantly more gun violence than R-rated films.
Can you talk a little bit about how you measured this and what else you found?
Yeah, sure. Well, we had a huge sample of studies. Actually, we looked at the top 30 grossing films every year since 1950. There are 945 films that we looked at. We looked at every 5 minutes of the film and counted the number of violent acts. And then from 1985 is the first year that the PG-13 rating was introduced, we looked at every five-minute segment as well, and counted the number of violent acts that depicted guns. And when the results showed that when the PG-13 rating was introduced in 1985, PG-13 films had about as much gun violence as G-rated and PG-rated films, which is basically none or very little. And by 2005, they contained as much violence as R-rated films, and that continued to climb. And in recent years, they've contained significantly more gun violence.
Now, so in terms of why we might be concerned about this, you talk about something called the weapons effect that could come into play with all these depictions of gun violence. What do we know about the weapons effect?
We know that the mere presence of a weapon makes people more aggressive. It's been replicated many times. In fact, in some of our studies, you don't even need to see the weapon. We did one study where participants saw the word gun for 17 one-hundredths of a second at a subliminal level, and they were more aggressive afterwards. So it's in the human brain, the link between guns and aggression is very strong.
Any particular impact on teen audiences, or is this just across the board? We see a gun and we act more aggressive.
It's across the board. Well, we haven't looked at the effect in really young people, but for teens and young adults and adults, the effect occurs.
Can you clarify a little bit what the ratings are supposed to mean and how the content is supposed to match those ratings?
Well, it's supposed to match, but it doesn't, and that's the problem. I think many parents think that PG-13 films contain less violence than R-rated films, and I think they'd be shocked to discover they actually contain significantly more violence, and it's a big problem. We know from other research that teens who see movie characters smoke cigarettes think they're cool. They're more likely to experiment and try smoking themselves. And, of course, once you start smoking, it's some people never stop. The same is true with alcohol. Research has shown that young audiences who see movie characters drinking alcohol think they're cool and are more likely to experiment with alcohol themselves. What we would like to know, and what we're doing future research to test, is whether young viewers who see movie characters using guns, if they think that's also cool, and if it changes their perceptions about guns, and actually whether they're more interested in guns. So that's where our research is heading.
So what gets a movie an R then? Is it just sex? If it's not violence, is that what's left?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess what we'd like to suggest is the movie industry go back to the way it was when the PG-13 rating was introduced. So R-rated movies haven't changed much. Movies always received an R rating due to sex or sometimes profanity, such as the F word. But what has changed dramatically is there used to be depictions of violence were rated R, but that's no longer true. And we think they should be. We think that films containing gun violence should be rated R.
I'm curious about what kind of movies, you know, in a time capsule in 1985, you know, would have gotten a PG-13 rating, and now what a typical PG-13 example would be. Can you give a couple examples?
Well, we know the reason the PG-13 rating was introduced is because of movies like Indiana Jones. But the movies now that we looked at were movies such as The Dark Knight, Terminator, Salvation, Inception, Transformers, Dark of the Moon, Captain America, The First Avenger, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
Matrix?
The Avengers. I think that may have been rated R. I don't have all the ratings in front of me. But what's really interesting is that the Terminator movies, for example, used to all be rated R. And the most recent version, Terminator Salvation, was rated PG-13, and our analysis actually shows it contains more gun violence, the PG-13 version, than the previously rated R versions. The same is true for the Die Hard series. The old Die Hard series movies were rated R, but the most recent version, Live Free or Die Hard, was rated PG-13, and it actually contains more gun violence than the R-rated versions.
So if you're a parent who's concerned about this, I mean, what's the solution? If you've got, you know, a 13-year-old, 14, 15, and, you know, they want to see the movies that their friends are seeing, you're concerned about the effect of violence, what should parents do?
Yeah, well, they won't be so popular with their kids, but just because a movie's rated PG-13 doesn't mean that kids 13 and older should see that movie. Certainly, kids under 13 should not see it.
Is part of what we're kind of talking around here the fear that, you know, we're living in an era right now of mass shootings, Newtown, Columbine, and kids who are impressionable will go to these movies and they'll be more likely to walk away with a blueprint?
Yeah, we don't know. We do know that children learn scripts for how to behave from observing other people. It could be their parents or siblings or peers or media characters, and they use these scripts to guide their own behavior when they're in similar situations. Of course, we will never know whether violence in the media causes violent criminal behavior. We know there's a link, but we don't know if it's a causal link, just like we'll never know whether smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer, because you can't do experimental studies to test it. You can't randomly assign people to smoke or not smoke and see whether they get lung cancer. And likewise, you can't randomly assign kids to watch violent or nonviolent movies and then give them guns and see what they do with those in our laboratory experiments. It's just not possible or ethical to do that, and we wouldn't want to even if we could. So, but we do know that violence in the media causes aggressive behavior. We do know that kids who are exposed to violent media behave more aggressively. It can make them behave more aggressively, and it can also make them numb to the pain and suffering of others.
So what would you like to see change based on what you found?
Well, I'd like to see films that contain gun violence rated R.
All right. And do you think the odds are pretty good that the Motion Picture Association will check out this study and do something about it? Or is this, kind of a long shot?
Well, I've contacted the Motion Picture Association of America to share the results of our study with them. Haven't heard back from them yet. I know that several of the journalists who have interviewed me about this study have also tried to contact them, but they none of them have heard back either. But it's a huge problem because I think parents rely on these ratings to make choices about the media diets for their children, and they count on these ratings to be accurate. And the Motion Picture Association of America's website says that R-rated films contain more violence than PG-13 films, when exactly the opposite is true. PG-13 films contain significantly more violence than R-rated films, and that's a big problem.
All right. Well, Brad, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Brad Bushman. He's a professor of communication and psychology at The Ohio State University.
Coming up next, a look at why firstborns may be smarter than their younger siblings.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A new study says first children may be smarter, that firstborns perform better in school, they have higher IQs than younger siblings. But why? Well, we've got Derek Thompson with us. He's senior editor for The Atlantic, where he oversees the business channel. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So first, tell us about this study. What did they find?
Right. So, when I grew up, I sort of subscribed to what I called the first pancake theory of parenting, the idea that the first pancake tends to come out a little funny, and so the kids tend to get better as they proceed. My younger sister certainly is a lot more responsible than I am. But, you go around the world, and people have studied this question, who performs better in school, who earns more later in life? Is it first children or second and third children? And it's not just here in the U.S. It's all around the world that you see surveys of birth order finding the firstborn have higher IQs, they perform better in school, their parents consider them more accomplished. So it is this study in particular that looked at children, but it's also a lot of other studies, which gives you a sense that it's not just a mistake that a couple researchers made a few years ago. This is potentially a very real thing.
And this keeps holding up in all these different studies.
Yeah, exactly right. And so, people have sort of tried to figure out, all right, we seem to have stumbled upon something, that first children have higher IQs, that their parents consider them more successful, more attuned in school. That's certainly what this recent study showed that looked at parents' evaluations of their children. And so the question is, right, why exactly is this the case? And there's a lot of theories. One that I find sort of interesting, the first that I find most intuitive, is just the divided attention theory. If you think of attention like any other currency, the idea is that earlier born siblings simply enjoy more parent time. And then as there are more siblings, attention is divided between fewer kids, and each subsequent child receives less parenting.
So the parental attention is a constant. The first kid gets N divided by 1, the second gets N divided by 2, and so on.
Perfectly
down the line.
Said. Exactly.
All right. And so that's one of them, divided attention. Now, some people, and this seems to be going away, but there's a genetic idea that the good stuff, good genes got used up early.
Right, right. There's the bad genes theory. One that I find somewhat intuitive is what I call the I've had it with kids theory. And here's the idea that, let's say, you're a parent, you have a first child, it's absolutely fantastic, you love it. Maybe you have another and another, and you only stop when you realize that, the last child is simply too much work to possibly consider another. In that case, you're going to stop essentially with the worst child, and not have any more. You're not going to divide your attention anymore going on down the line. But this particular study, the most recent one, is what I call the lazy parent theory. And here's the idea that you have first time parents, and they don't want to mess up their new child, so they essentially install a lot of energy into making sure that that this first kid sort of acts as the enforcer for the younger siblings. And so essentially the older child learns to be a kind of surrogate parent, and that there are certain advantages to being put in this position. So that within the family, the first child is lucky because he or she has the chance to teach and to instruct and to be a father or mother figure for the younger siblings, and that this is really, really good for development. So that for developmental reasons, there's a lot of advantages to being the first one born.
And then another theory that you wrote about is a different permutation of laziness, I guess, with that first kid. And I felt this as a first-time parent, not wanting to get things wrong. You're putting your all into it. You're checking each step of the way, avoiding those screw-ups. And then after you've been through it, you're like, wow, I really overthought a lot of that. And so you're more hands-off on the second kid. Well, but maybe that crazy overparenting the first time around paid some kind of dividends.
Right, exactly. Right. The idea is that, you know, for the first child, you essentially, you know, you buy Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, and you just memorize every single chapter, and you're like, I'm going to be the best parent ever.
You're going to be the president violin, you know,
right,
sports star.
Yeah. And all of this stuff. And then, you know, over time, you realize that you don't have to go through all of this to raise a child that's good enough, that you love, that you enjoy hanging out with, that doesn't cry too loudly in restaurants and all of this. And so you chill out. And in chilling out, potentially, you can see that, you know, there may be major minor differences in achievement level in school, because you essentially say, I don't need all of my children to be A+. I'm okay with B+ or B, so long as they turn out to be nice people.
Mm-hmm. Now, and then there's the divorce theory. Talk through that one.
Right. And so this is the idea that, you know, a family crisis probably isn't going to happen, you know, before the first child is born. You know, you have divorce often. If you have a first child, in any case, it's usually while the first child is alive. And so that disruption, which might not take place during the developmental process of the first child, is taking place, and that disruption is very present in the life of subsequent children. And so there you see that a divorce will have a higher and more serious impact on the second, third child than it will on the first, because that first child is more likely to have grown up, at least initially, with a unified home.
Well, now here's another thought. I don't know if this theory came up in what you looked at, but is there a societal assumption that first kids are going to be better in some way and get more attention? And that's just talking about it demoralizes the younger siblings and makes them not try as hard.
You know, right, my sense, honestly, is that you can come up with a rationale for why almost any kid is likely to be the most coddled, right? If you're the first child, you know, you are royalty. If you're the last child, you grow up the baby. If you're the middle child, you have this experience of negotiating authority while being an authority figure to your younger child. There's all sorts of ways you can, you know, rationalize why any given child should technically be the smartest, the most well-adaptive. And as you know, there are all sorts of theories about what older children are like and what middle children are like and why younger children need more attention and so on and so forth. What I found interesting about these studies and these theories is that they're not just old wisdom. This is research, and it's not just U.S. research. It's research around the world in Scandinavian countries too that do seem to show that for whatever reason, the first child seems to have a higher IQ, seems to perform better in the eyes of their parents.
Well, it seems like
the rationales have to be searched for because the data is there.
Well, and it seems like this is just IQ. I could say I did a little better in school than my younger brother, but he's more creative. He's better at hands-on stuff than I am. Is there just in 30 seconds or so? Is there research into other ways of measuring the output of the different birth order kids?
Right. Yeah, I mean, here, you're right. You're essentially saying, you know, what can we know about kids at this young age that can sort of predict their future outcomes? And unfortunately, we don't know that much. IQ tends to be a decent but not, you know, terribly perfect predictor. You know, the truth, honestly, is that, and this is going to be such a cop-out answer, I apologize in advance, there are just billions of children. So you're going to have so much variety of experience, first, second, third children, and increasingly in developed countries where there are more. But, you know, I think what's important to know about this study is that when you look at Europe, Japan, the United States, other developed countries, families in these countries aren't having three or four kids. They're having one or two. And so they're going to pay much more attention to research that looks at what are first and second children going to be like.
All right, Derek, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up later in the program, Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss shares his recommendations for great reads in the fantasy and science fiction realms.
First, we've got punctuation on the brain, from periods to quotation marks and everything in between. Punctuation plays a pretty big role in our everyday lives.
Our next guest found the stories behind our favorite punctuation marks and some lesser-known ones as well. And the story of punctuation is closely intertwined, he found, with religion, technology, culture, and the age-old desire to accurately represent what we're trying to say.
Joining us now is the creator of the Shady Characters blog, Keith Houston. He's got a new book based on the blog called Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation, Symbols and Other Typographical Marks. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like you first got interested in this topic. You came across a pilcrow, which I had no idea what that was. In fact, it turned out I'd seen it. But tell us about this interesting pilcrow.
Yeah, the pilcrow it looks a bit like a pea. The bowl of the pea is filled in, and it's also reversed. It's sometimes called a reversed pea. I was reading a book by an English sculptor and typographer who was called Eric Gill. During the time that he was alive, he was revered. He was a very popular sort of respected figure in the English art world. But then after he died, it turned out he was actually a pretty reprehensible guy. So this book I find very interesting is about typography, and he had a very kind of arts and crafts sort of ethos running through it, with this pilcrow, this little paragraph mark peppered all the way through it. I didn't know what it was, so I read about it, and it seemed that there was so much story, there's so much history, in fact, behind this single character, going all the way back to basically before punctuation itself. And the project just sort of exploded from there, really.
So what do we know about the origins of punctuation, where it came from in the first place?
Well, it started off, it wasn't really for writers, it was for readers. So if you're an ancient Greek, let's say sort of Homer's time or after that, many centuries BC, you had no punctuation. The text was just, all the letters were crammed together. There were no spaces between words. There were no periods or exclamation marks. You had to pick out words and syllables as you read. So reading was often done aloud. And it turned out that the readers then started to add marks. A librarian at the Library of Alexandria came up with a system of marks that said, basically, this is a short pause, this is a long pause, and this is a final pause. And these were points, which is where the term punctuation comes from. So basically, punctuation was invented to help readers. They would mark up their text so that when they read them back again, they had a better idea of the cadences, of the rhythm of the sentences. And it gradually was co-opted by writers, and more formal systems evolved, more symbols evolved as well. But that's where it started.
It's interesting that there is this trove of these old punctuation marks, and some of them have gone the way of the dinosaurs. They've just slipped away from us. Others have gone on to new lives. Tell us about one of your favorites that we may have overlooked.
There is a mark called the interrobang, which was invented by an advertising executive in the 1960s. It's a combination of a question mark and an exclamation mark. And he was sick of his copywriters putting these two marks together to signal a kind of an excited question or a rhetorical question. I think the best example is, who forgot to put gas in the car? you know exactly who forgot to put gas in the car, but it's a sort of an exclamation as much as a question. And so he thought, let's actually invent a mark, which is just a single symbol for this sort of usage. So he wrote a couple of magazine articles about it. He had his art director drop some designs, and it almost took off. I mean, incredibly, he basically just conjured this mark out of thin air. His name was Martin Spector. And within, I think, 5 or 10 years, you could buy a typewriter with an interrobang key in it. You could buy a font if you wanted to print something with an interrobang in it. And it almost caught on. It was so close. You can type one on a computer if you know what you're doing. But it basically just kind of slipped away. It didn't quite reach the critical mass that a mark of punctuation needs to have in order to actually work. And I actually ended up talking to the wife of this man, Martin K. Spector, in New York last year, and it was just amazing. It sounds a bit pompous perhaps, but it felt like being part of the story, actually being able to talk to this lovely woman about this this sort of inventive mark of punctuation. So I think I'd have to say that's my favorite.
It's got a fantastic name, doesn't it? And I feel like with our modern, the way we text so often and in Twitter so often, people use excess punctuation, tons of exclamation points, couple question marks. You have to face it. The interrobang is more efficient, isn't it? Shouldn't we just bring this back?
Oh, Twitter should be promoting it. Absolutely. I think it makes quite a lot of sense. Also, perhaps another thing that might be useful is the concept of an irony mark. And people keep on trying to invent irony marks. And basically, they try and they fail. And someone else tries and they fail. And we've been doing this for about 300 years. And I think that would make a huge difference, especially for online communication when you perhaps don't have many symbols or many characters to play with. And yet, it never quite works.
Well, it seems like a natural, though, doesn't it? Because as you write about, the role of the punctuation is to try to precisely convey what we're trying to say. And irony is really hard to convey in an email sometimes and can cause much confusion and delay among people being ironic and sarcastic with each other. But can we make this happen? What would it take to make this catch on?
That's a very good question. The problem, I think, often boils down to the technology. Before we started printing things with computers, before we started communicating with computers, you had the typewriter. And so you were effectively constrained to what was on the typewriter keyboard. So some marks basically got squeezed out of existence. Before typewriters came along, we had lots of dashes. We had very short dashes, we had very long dashes, all kinds of dashes for different purposes. The typewriter has exactly one dash on it, which serves as a dash or a hyphen or any of these other sort of family of dashes. And to get a new key onto the typewriter keyboard was very difficult, hence why the interrobang didn't quite make it. And I think the same is true now. If it's not possible to type something absolutely trivially just by hitting one key on your computer keyboard, then I worry that there maybe isn't much chance for it. I mean, you know, technically it's feasible. There's nothing stopping us doing this, but I think it's perhaps technology. Plus, I'm not sure people want more punctuation in a sense. It feels like we have a fixed number of characters in our head that we can deal with, and I wonder if an extra one would just be too much.
How do you feel about emoticons? Are you a fan of the smiley face?
Yes, in as much as it's sometimes useful. It's sometimes useful for communicating irony or, you know, saying what I've just said is a joke. And it's recognizable. I mean, I wouldn't use it in a formal email or a formal letter. Or a book, for that mark. Sorry, for that matter. But I'd be quite happy using it in a tweet or a personal email.
One of my favorite history lessons in your book is the roots of the ampersand. Now, a lot of the things you talk about are from the brainiest people of their time, Cicero, or you said the librarian at the Library of Alexandria. Where did the ampersand, the symbol for and, come from?
Well, the first recorded ampersand was some graffiti on a wall in Pompeii. So someone had felt it necessary to write something. Unfortunately, the rest of the bit of graffiti is not recorded. But yeah, it was effectively just an E and a T, so the Latin word et or and somebody had written it a bit quickly, and the two kind of touched, the stem of the T touched one of the kind of the arms of the E, and that was basically the first ampersand. You can trace a sort of family tree pretty much from there, all the way through to the ampersand that you might see printed in a book now.
And the ampersand for font makers seems to be their chance to cut loose. Even the boringest font out there, they really have fun with the ampersand a lot of the time.
Yeah, it is. It's very much a sort of canvas, as you say, to kind of cut loose. I think there's a fairly standard way that a typographer will approach setting a book or a website, and that is to use the best ampersand you have. It's actually, this is incredibly nerdy, it's quite a lot of fun to create an ampersand in Microsoft Word and just to sort of scroll down through different fonts to see what people have done with the ampersand. Some of them are very abstract. It's this sort of formalized ampersand we have now, which doesn't really look like et at all. And then some basically are the letters E and T kind of banged together in a slightly creative way. So, it's very much maybe a little signature of the person who's designing a given font.
Well, one punctuation mark that's gone on to be a superstar in today's world, you wouldn't have known it by its ungainly name, Octothorpe. it's, I guess, not better known as the hashtag. Tell us a little bit about where that one came from.
Yeah, well, the mark and its name have two sort of separate origins. The mark itself, in America, you call it the pound sign, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. And it comes from the abbreviation LB for this meant Libra Pondo, which is Latin for pound in weight. And so people wrote LB, and they would put a kind of a line through it or across it to mean this is an abbreviation. And as people wrote this LB bar or LB line down faster and faster and faster, this became the pound sign, the hash mark. So that's the mark. The fact that it's called the Octothorpe is entirely out of left field. It's weird. Bell Labs, which is part of AT&T, had to design a new telephone keypad. This is when we went from rotary dial telephones to push-button telephones. So they designed a system which had these two spare buttons. If you look at your phone, it'll have an asterisk or a star and a pound sign on it. And they needed a name for the pound sign. It's sometimes called the pound sign. It's sometimes called the number sign, sometimes called the hash mark. It has lots of different names, and no one of them was really agreed upon. And bizarrely enough, two different people who worked at Bell Labs claimed to have invented this word pretty much out of nowhere. Octo, because it has 8 points, and Thorpe for bizarre reasons. One was about an American athlete who had medals taken away from him at an early Olympic Games. His name was Jim Thorpe, and someone was trying to raise awareness of his case. So he said, let's call it the Octo Thorpe. So it is entirely bizarre, and yet it's about the most unambiguous way to refer to this symbol.
It's so funny that the mark itself has more fame, I guess, than Thorpe does at this point. Well, we're hearing a lot about these marks right now, learning some new stuff with our guest, Keith Houston, about the history and evolution of punctuation marks and typographical symbols. And we want to hear from you as well. Is there a punctuation mark that you've always been curious about, one that you wish would be used more often or maybe less often? Maybe you've got one of these typewriters kicking around with an interrobang on it. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about punctuation with Keith Houston. And you can join in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Keith, yeah, we were talking about, you have this lovely Scottish accent, but you actually have a Wisconsin connection, right?
I do, yes. My wife's family live in Wisconsin. I'm afraid my Wisconsin geography is not brilliant, but they live in and around Black River Falls, which is, I think, close to Eau Claire.
I think that's about right now. Excellent. Well, she may be out there listening right now. Well, let's go to the phones first. We've got Alex on the line from Madison. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Yes, I have a question about the earlier conversation regarding an irony mark. And I was wondering if the guest thought that perhaps one of the reasons that an irony mark hasn't arisen is because the very concept of irony is that some people are supposed to get it and some people are not. So maybe having an irony mark in an email that you forwarded around the office wouldn't necessarily convey the true sense, because there would be because a single meaning would be conveyed when maybe a different meaning was meant for different people.
Right. Good point. What do you think about that, Keith?
Yes. I think that certainly irony is saying one thing and meaning another, or saying one thing and not meaning it, basically. I agree that it's sometimes irony is most effective when it is very targeted, when only part of your audience gets the joke, effectively. But I think that in those cases, you might choose not to use an irony mark. In fact, that's part of the danger, or part of the difficulty with an irony mark. If you have it there, you may choose to use it sincerely, meaning I've just written something that's ironic. You might choose to use it ironically and not mean, and not actually mean it. So you've maybe written something which is not ironic and use an irony mark to confuse people, or again, to joke about it. Or you may choose not to mean it, but be ironic anyway. And I think this sort of confusion of uses is maybe one of the reasons why it's very difficult to make it work.
All right. Thanks for the call, Alex. We'll go to the phones again with Kathy in Delafield. Kathy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you both. I'd I think that the term hashtag, it to me, it just appeared overnight, and it seems to be used so much. It seems to be overused. But I was waiting for the answer as to why did it just suddenly appear on the horizon? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, basically, one of the original, a guy named Chris Messina, who was working for Twitter, I believe, at the time, certainly was one of the very early doctors of Twitter, and the hashtag or the hash mark was already in use in another slightly more obscure messaging slash social network type service, and it meant a kind of channel, like... let's see, we're talking about baseball, then you would be in the hash baseball channel. And he imported it to Twitter, and it took off. It was initially a kind of an informal thing, but it was so widely used that Twitter then built it into the way that Twitter works, and hence the hashtag is now, it's bound up with Twitter in the same way that the at symbol is bound up with email, I think. That's pretty much why it just appeared out of nowhere.
I was going to say, speaking of repurposed symbols used in technology, that at sign, now, first of all, before its current use, it's that A with the circle sort of around it. Seems like it should have a fancy name, but it's just the at symbol. That's it. That's all we got.
I have read recently that some people may be calling it the aspirand.
Oh.
So it's an adaptation of ampersand. I quite like aspirand.
Aspirand. No one will ever know what you're talking about, though. That's the only problem.
I'll have a nice cup of aspirin tea, I think. Yeah, that sounds pretty good. But so how did that become, as the hashtag was to Twitter, how did the at symbol become the email thing?
Well, no one is really sure where the symbol itself came from. It may just be an abbreviation for a word beginning with A, a sort of medieval abbreviation for it. It started to be used to mean amphora or amphora, which is a kind of a Roman or a Greek jug or vessel that was used to transport things. And from there, it took the meaning of, say, a number of items at a given price. So, you know, five apples at $1 each or something like that. And so it was useful enough in commercial circles that it made its way onto the typewriter keyboard. And it sat there, and if you had cause to use it, you used it. And if you didn't, you didn't. And when email was being invented, when someone basically conceptualized and wrote this email program, a guy called Ray Tomlinson, he needed a symbol for the addressing scheme. You know, I'm sending an email to a user at a given computer. And on his keyboard, which is derived from the typewriter keyboard, basically the only symbol that wasn't used for something else was the at symbol. So he chose it, and happily it had the right kind of meaning, some user at computer. And again, it just took off from there. Email very, very quickly went on to become the biggest thing on the internet, on the sort of the young internet. And so, again, like the hashtag, overnight almost, it went from sort of obscurity to very mainstream usage.
You know, one of my favorites, both for the symbol itself and for the name, is the manicule. Can you tell us about the birth and the death, I guess, of the manicule?
The manicule looks like a pointing hand. It's funny. Most other marks are stylized in some way. They've evolved a long way from their roots, and so they like the ampersand, for example. It doesn't really look like the letters E and T anymore for the most part. But the manicule looks like a hand. That's what it is. It's just a pointing hand. This seemed to come about in the Renaissance, where readers were very engaged with their books. They wanted to leave their mark upon them. When they read something that was interesting, they wanted to mark it. They wanted to say, look at this. I should come back to this, or I should reread this. And often they drew little pointing hands, and these were called manicules. Then what happened was printing came along, and suddenly authors were able to use these little pointing hands as well. And the manicule kind of switched allegiances from readers to writers, in the same way that punctuation had in general, in fact. And it just sort of died out. The use of the manicule by the reader just kind of went away. I think maybe writing in the margins in general is something which is, mm-hmm. has died out to a degree, and the manicule was taken with it. So now it's become a kind of a symbol that you know a bit about typography or printing, and it's a bit of a cult mark, a bit like the interrobang or the pilcro. It shows that you know your stuff, and Yeah, it's now just a curiosity rather than a mark that you might use in everyday writing.
Of our standard arsenal of punctuation, the periods and commas and question marks, do you have a favorite or one that you feel is maybe redundant or doesn't do the job it should?
I'm not sure I have a favorite. I'm in the process of writing the follow-up to Shady Characters, and it turns out I use a lot of semicolons. I think people worry that the semicolon is going to become extinct. If I have anything to do with it, it won't. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, knowing the set of punctuation symbols that we have available to us, I try to use them all as correctly as I can. I'm not sure there's any one I would say is redundant necessarily. They all have their place.
Do you know anything about how it came to be that when we were trying to tactfully censor curse words, that we ended up using a slew of punctuation marks instead?
Yeah, so I think basically dashes, ampersands, and periods have all been used to do this. I'm not entirely sure where it started, but where it really took off was in reporting of parliamentary proceedings in England, where it was actually illegal to report in parliamentary proceedings. So magazines would just censor the names of people taking part in these debates, and that's really that seems to be where it really took off. It's also when the novel, when the concept of the novel came about, and instead of going for very fanciful, idealistic characters, novelists tried to make it a bit more realistic. So Moll Flanders, for example, one of the first novels, has lots of dashes because it wants to make you think that the writer may be talking about real people and he doesn't want to offend them. So it was to do with realism as well, bizarrely enough. It was to heighten the sense of realism in a work of fiction.
Okay, last quickie question here. Would you have a favorite one coming on the horizon?
A favorite
punctuation mark that might be up and coming?
Oh, there's an irony mark that looks like a zigzag exclamation mark. It's Dutch. It's called the Irony Tech, and I would love it if it succeeded. I think it looks great.
Excellent. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're talking to Keith Houston. He's the author of Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation, Symbols, and Other Typographical Marks.